Is everything the way it's supposed to be? Hello? Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Unmute. Okay, now I figured out how to unmute.
Okay, Arlene, attendees are starting to arrive.
Video.
Okay. Welcome, Arlene.
Thank you.
We have already quite many attendees that are saying hi from Iceland. I will have a short introduction.
I can't hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Okay.
Welcome, Arlene. I will have a short introduction. We already have quite many attendees, and I believe we will have many more on Facebook. And good evening, everyone, and a warm welcome to our first online event. We will be inviting you guys for some fun Zoom hangouts this winter, where we talk about mountaineering, and we're also planning to dig further into the outdoor industry from other aspects. We will get to know the people who add to our experiences with their innovations and entrepreneurship. It's a true honor to introduce the guest of the evening, a woman who has traveled the world and been a true pioneer in her work. She has been breaking trail for many of us, and we can learn a lot from her experiences. Her name is Arlene Bloom, and she is a PhD biophysical chemist, author, and a mountaineer. She's a research associate in chemistry at University of Berkeley, and executive director of Green Science Policy Institute. Tonight, she will share her experience with us, both from her amazing mountaineering expeditions and her science work that aims for making our environment a safer place. We can learn a lot from her regarding leadership, teamwork, pushing through in hard conditions, and how to stand up for ourselves. We will go back to the golden years of mountaineering and alpinism, when expeditions were not as accessible as they are today, and when you needed to be a part of a team, and there was no internet to sign up for commercial expeditions. Arlene has inspired me personally in many ways, and I first learned about her achievements from some older and wiser climbers while having a pizza on the famous Fire and Ice restaurant in Kathmandu. And I actually happened to be complaining about something when I was introduced to Arlene's story. Well, I did not complain more during that trip. And I got so inspired that my travel agency started to sell women's trip up to Annapurna Base Camp. And the ladies who joined in were equally inspired. And many of them are here with us tonight. And Arlene, they send you a special regards. And I hope you enjoy the evening. And I want to welcome Arlene to our virtual stage. And thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
You're welcome. Well, thanks so much. And nice to be talking to all of you in Iceland. I was really hoping to visit Iceland this summer, but Americans weren't welcome with reason. So I hope to come another time and speak with many of you and meet you in person. So I'm going to now share some slides, and at the end, I'm happy to have questions. You can write things in the chat, or we can have our questions live. You know, people can raise their hand and talk at the end. So let's just see. Okay. So I call my talk Mountains and Molecules because I'm going to be talking about mountain climbing and also doing scientific research to help improve all of our health. And I think they're quite similar, the skills that you need for mountain climbing and the skills that you need for making a difference in the world. So let's see where my slide changer went. We had quite a time getting onto Zoom today. This is going to work now. Well, my adventures all started in my freshman chemistry laboratory in Portland, Oregon. My professor was a brilliant 23-year-old PhD chemist from MIT, and she thought chemistry was the interesting thing in the world. And there were four girls in my class. We all got doctorates in chemistry. My lab partner was a handsome young man who climbed mountains. Here he is on top of Mount Hood. And late one starry night, he asked me if I wanted to climb Mount Hood, and he was very handsome, so I said, sure. And I was from the Midwestern United States, had never done anything very physical in my life, and was gasping going out of the parking lot, but he was very handsome. I continued gasping, and when we got high on the mountain, I thought it was the most beautiful place I'd ever been, and I fell in love with him and with mountain climbing, and started climbing mountains, mostly in Oregon. But when I was in graduate school, I got invited to go on an expedition to Denali, McKinley, the highest mountain in North America, by some friends who were guys. And then I learned the leader of the expedition would only allow men on the trip. He said women weren't physically strong enough or emotionally stable enough to climb mountains like Denali. And I thought that was wrong, so I decided to organize an all-women's expedition to Denali. That was way back in 1970, and no women's team had even tried Denali or I guess many other hard mountains. And so there were six of us, and in those days we hadn't thought about carrying sleds, pulling our things on sleds, which is what people now did. So we were indeed carrying like very heavy loads, 70 pounds, and but we could do it. And we got up high on the mountain, beautiful place. Our leader, Grace Homan, was an experienced Alaskan climber, but she'd not gone to altitudes. She didn't do very well up high. And here she is at our high camp at 17,000 feet on summit day, really not feeling well. I was the deputy leader, though at the time I was like 25 and not that experienced. And I said, well, maybe you shouldn't go today if you have a migraine and you're not feeling well. But she insisted she wanted to. So we reached the summit, all six of us. I took the picture. And this was the first time a team of women did climb Denali, but you can see Grace kind of, she's on the lower right, kind of slumped down in the snow, and she wasn't drinking or eating or talking. And just below the summit, she collapsed unconscious. And that was like a transformational moment for me. As I said, I was 25 and suddenly I was the leader of this expedition near the summit of Denali with an unconscious person. And so we had a pack frame and a sleeping bag, and we made a stretcher and we hauled and lowered Grace down the mountain, down to a bivvy site above 18,000 feet. And then the clouds came in and it looked like a storm was coming in. It got dark briefly in the Arctic twilight. And in the morning, Grace was a bit better. We got her down in the blizzard. The blizzard did come in, and then we sat in our tent at about 14,000 feet for several days, every 3 hours having to shovel off the tent. But for me, it really started my career as an expedition leader, because I'd had a kind of tough childhood with a lot of negative messages and hadn't felt that good about myself. And I remember still sitting in that tent in the big blizzards, thinking, boy, we got Grace down the mountain alive. We got to the top of Denali. You know, it was very empowering for me to have climbed the mountain and gotten Grace down. And the storm ended and we came down successfully. And the next sort of big event in my life was I was at Berkeley in graduate school, hard at work, not finishing my thesis, and went to the movies and saw a movie called The Endless Summer. I don't know if you remember that. It was the Beach Boys going around the world looking for a perfect wave for surfing. And I thought, well, I'm a mountain climber. I want to do an endless winter. And so in the chemistry library, I planned out that I'd do a season in Europe, a season in Africa, one in Asia, go down to Australia, New Zealand, and have an endless winter after I finished my doctorate. And so I finished my doctorate back in December of 1971, and then spent 15 months doing what I had dreamed up that night. And I won't go through it all, but this is, believe it or not, the highest peak in Congo and Uganda. It's the Congo-Uganda border. Margarita, if you don't realize that there are high glaciated peaks in Africa. And I had done my research on a molecule called transfer RNA. So I told my PhD advisor, I'd think about my research while I was climbing. So here I am in the highest peak at point in Uganda and Congo with my little flag saying transfer RNA. And we climbed in Afghanistan, wonderful people. And here I am again with my flag. And in Afghanistan, we were climbing Noshak, which is a 24,000 foot high mountain at the same time with a Polish expedition, including the very famous Polish woman climber, Wanda Rutkiewicz. And so in a moment, I was going up towards the summit of Noshak at about 23,000 feet on my way up. And Wanda was coming down from the summit. That was her first big summit, was Noshak. And she gave me a big hug and said, at that point, no 8,000 meter peaks had been climbed by any women. And Wanda said, we must climb Annapurna together, all women. It was her idea. And so that happened high on Noshak in Afghanistan. So on this trip, we continued doing first descents. This is in Kashmir, where we did about 6 first descents. And during that trip, I guess I was 26 or 27 then, I gained a lot of experience at organizing expeditions, having dreams, and helping them become reality. And so I kept climbing and doing chemistry until a life-changing event for me that happened on a mountain called Trisul in India, which is a 24,000 foot mountain that was said to be very easy to climb. You can see it looks like a nice easy walk. And I was climbing with a young climber named Bruce Carson, who was then America's leading young rock climber. He was the first person to pioneer climbing the steep faces in Yosemite Valley without the use of any pitons. In the old days, people drove pitons into the rock. And he was an early environmentalist and said, we shouldn't use pitons and let's use chalks. And he was the first person to climb grade 6s in Yosemite Valley using chalks. And he led then famous climbers like Yvon Chouinard and Royal Robbins. He talked them into doing grade 6s without pitons. So he was on our trip and I'm kind of a slow walker. He was ahead with some of the other climbers. And when I got to the summit, they said, we think Bruce is lost. And I was like, what? And we looked and it looked like there was a higher summit across from us. And we saw Bruce's footsteps heading to where the higher summit was and then ending. And there'd been a huge cornice and he had walked out on the cornice and fell. We didn't know there was a 5,000 foot face under that cornice. And he felt his death. And I was incredibly devastated and depressed. And I remember we then went to fly home. We spent a night in what was then Bombay, now Mumbai. And I was walking the streets, which were full of sleeping people, thinking, I want to do something in honor of Bruce. And he was an early environmentalist who really cared about clean climbing, but cared about a clean environment and a healthy world. And so I came back and I said, what can I do to help the environment? And I was a postdoctoral fellow at Stanford then, studying how proteins fold. But on my orals committee in graduate school, there was a scientist named Bruce Ames who had a test to see if chemicals were likely to cause cancer. And here's a picture of Bruce. He was just 23 when he died falling through the cornice, and just an extraordinary climber and environmentalist. So I said, in honor of Bruce, I want to do something to help the environment. And he said, well, could you look at children's pajamas? The pajamas that kids are wearing all over North America, they're 10% by weight, this flame retardant. And I think it gets into the children, and I think it's problematic. And this all seemed really strange to me, flame retardants, children. But I was very depressed that Bruce had died, and I'm like, sure, I'll study them. And so we found a little girl whose mom had bought her pajamas in Europe. So she wasn't wearing pajamas treated with Trist flame retardant. And so we moved the child into wearing Trist pajamas, and we collected her urine. And the first morning, the little girl's urine was full of cancer-causing chemicals. And every day she wore the pajamas, the level went up. And when she stopped wearing the pajamas, the level went down. And we realized that these cancer-causing chemicals were going from the pajamas into the child. And then we did another study to see, was this chemical likely to cause cancer? Did it change DNA? And was it a mutagen? And it turned out the chemical in the pajamas was one of the strongest mutagens and likely cancer-causing chemicals we'd ever seen. And we went, oh my goodness, all the children in America, Canada, I don't know about Iceland, maybe you were more like Europe, but in North America, all the kids pretty much were wearing pajamas that were 10% this chemical that got into them. And I thought, oh dear, I really need to write a paper proving all this, have it peer reviewed, and let the parents of America know about the problem with the children's pajamas. So at that moment, I got invited to this molecule, climb this mountain. So maybe I'll ask Vila, do you know what mountain this is?
Yes, I believe so.
What mountain? I can't hear you now. Are you off mute?
Yeah, it's Mount Everest.
It's Mount Everest, yeah. Right. And at that point, no American woman had ever tried Everest. And so I had this terrible choice. Was I going to stay in America and tell all the parents about the cancer-causing chemicals in the children's pajamas, or was I going to have the opportunity to be the first American woman to try Everest? A terrible decision. I could ask you all what you want to do. I think I know what Villa would do, but I did both. So I went to Everest, but while I was climbing up the beautiful Khumbu Icefall and going across steep ladders, across crevasses and up steep faces, every night I would get to camp and I would write my paper. And this is my high point on Everest. It's about 24.5. And my flag has a petri dish that doesn't have the Trist in it. So there are very few colonies of bacteria. And then one that did, which had Trist. And so I just finished my paper. I sent it by mail runner from high on Everest back to Kathmandu. And it was we reached the summit. We were the second American expedition, the Bicentennial Expedition. We climbed Everest in October of 76. And a few months later, my paper was published as a lead article in Science magazine. And the subtitle in the paper says a lot about what we do now at our institute. The main flame retardant in children's pajamas is a mutagen and should not be used. And this is an unusual thing for scientists to say. If any of you read scientific papers, you know how they always end. And maybe I won't ask you that question, Billy. You probably don't read too many scientific papers these days. But they always end by saying more study is needed, because that's a really safe thing to say. And we said that this chemical in all children's pajamas was problematic and we should stop using them. And because we took a really strong position, that's what happened. 3 months later, this chemical was banned from children's pajamas. And that was a really good thing. And that's what we try to do at our institute. Unfortunately, when this chemical called brominated tris was banned, the replacement was an almost identical chemical called chlorinated tris. Because when a bad chemical is phased out, it's expensive to change industrial processes. And the most likely thing is to replace one chemical with a chemical cousin that has the same structure, function, and toxicity. So we ran more tests. The chlorinated tris also changed DNA, was cancer causing, and it was also removed from pajamas. But what we didn't know is it continued being used in furniture, and we'll come to that later. Again, hopefully not in Iceland, but certainly across North America. So after Everest, I realized that women just had not much chance to climb high peaks, 8,000 meter peaks, and they'd all been climbed by men, but hardly any women had ever even tried to climb to 8,000 meters. And I decided that I would apply for a permit for a women's expedition for an 8,000 meter peak. And I chose Annapurna because it was the first 8,000 meter peak climbed. Maurice Herzog's French expedition did incredible explorations, found the mountain, climbed it way back in 1950. And I thought, well, it's the first 8,000 meter peak climbed. It must be one of the safest and easiest. And I think you all know that that's not accurate, but that's what we thought back then. So I organized a team of women. We're all still friends. We have reunions. The COVID has disturbed our next reunion, which was going to be in April, but we're optimistic we'll have it eventually. And so we made these t-shirts to raise money, and we actually raised most of the $80,000 budget for our trip selling these t-shirts. And that's how I think I connected with Villa First. I noticed I was getting all these, and we still sell the t-shirts. So I was suddenly noticed I was getting all these t-shirt orders from Iceland. And I thought, why are so many people in Iceland buying our t-shirts? Because we usually sell like about one t-shirt a month. It's kind of a very minor business. And so I wrote and I learned that there was a women's trek to Annapurna Base Camp wearing our t-shirts. And so that indirectly contributed to my having the opportunity to share all these stories with you. So these were the two women Sherpas we'd hoped we would train to climb on the mountain, and that did not turn out too well, which I describe in my book. The Sherpa Union was not so in favor of it. So Annapurna is gorgeous mountain, really hard to get to, hard to climb. There's lots of steep ice climbing, big storms, huge avalanches. This cloud was nearly 2 miles wide. So we had many adventures, which I won't have time to tell you about today. Tragically, we lost two of our team, but we did climb along this very narrow ridge, the Dutch Rib, and reached the summit. Two of the women on our team, two Sherpas, and we unfurled an American flag, a Nepali flag held together by a Save the Whales pin. And this is Irene, the first American woman to climb Annapurna 1, who I went hiking with Irene a few weeks ago. We're still good friends. So after that, we had lost two of our team and it was very devastating. And I decided to organize another women's expedition where we carried all of our own loads, because again, people had said, well, you had Sherpas, it wasn't really women. And I was like, well, we had six Sherpas on Everest, we had 40 Sherpas and nobody seemed to mind, but we decided no Sherpas, it would just be women. And we went to a mountain called Brigapan, which is above the source of the Ganges in India. It's right next to, I'm forgetting the name, bad at names. There's a very steep mountain where there's a very dramatic movie done by Jimmy Chen. Do you know the name of that movie, Villa? Have you seen it? It's the mountain at the, you know the mountain I mean? It's a very dramatic climbing movie. Anyway, you don't know the name. Do you remember it? Oops, I can't hear you.
Might be Mera or Meru.
Meru, exactly. Yeah. So Brigapan is right next to Meru. So we were watching, it's not as hard. We were watching it the whole time and we did climb Brigapan. We made the first descent. And we were we had invited two Indian women climbers to be part of our expedition to learn from us. And one of them became the first Indian woman to attempt Everest. And so we were congratulated by Indira Gandhi. And I had always wanted to see all the places in the Indian Himalayas, but to get to them, they're very twisty roads. They're very hard to get to. The plains are low, the Himalayas are high, and I get motion sick, and I really didn't like the bus rides. So I had always thought if I could walk across the whole Himalayas, I could see all these places without any bus rides. And so I'd always wanted to do that, but the Indian borders are closed to Westerners. You can't do that. So I got to meet Indira Gandhi and I said, could you help us get permission to walk across the Himalayas? And she said, yes, and she did. And so with her help, we did what I called the Great Himalayan Traverse. We started in Eastern Bhutan and we walked across Bhutan, Sikkim, all of Nepal and the Indian Himalayas to Ladakh, which was about 10 months of wonderful walking, my favorite year of my life. And I have a very bad sense of direction. People are really shocked that I say I'm directionally impaired. So I have to go with people with good senses of direction on adventures. And I met Hugh Swift, who had just finished writing guidebooks to the Himalaya and Karakoram. So Hugh said he would figure out how to make the route. There weren't really maps much in those days, so it was quite challenging to figure out the route. And I would do the politics, and it was some work, but we got permission to walk across Bhutan, which nobody had ever done before. No Westerner, I'm sure other people, no Westerner had done before. So we got all of our permits, and we walked up and down across the grain of the land, you know, up to a ridge, down to a valley. Hugh keep track of data. He said we went up and down about 1,000 meters a day for 10 months. So it was very up and down. We always arrived, it seems like, in places at very auspicious days for festivals. We arrived in Bhutan for their biggest archery festival. And most everywhere we were, they'd never seen Westerners before. So people were just incredibly hospitable. It was very wonderful. We came to Sikkim on the day the Dalai Lama was giving a talk in English. So you see the young Dalai Lama here, and he was there one day and we were there the same day. It was really inspiring. We entered Nepal on the Dasai festival on the day of the dog, where dogs are given special treats. And after that, I started something called the Himalayan Fair here in Berkeley. Every May, we have a huge Himalayan festival. We didn't have it last May because of the COVID, and I don't know about this. You're ever in Berkeley in May, you're invited to the Himalayan Fair. So my most recent adventures have been with my daughter, Annalise. When she was really young, we thought we would carry her across the Alps from Yugoslavia to France. And there she is in the mountain meadows. She was 3 to 6 months old. This was Patagonia made the first Gore-Tex baby suit for us, for Annalise. And one of the very first baby packs was again made for her. So those were my adventures. And I've written a couple of books. Annapurna, A Woman's Place, tells the story of my expedition on Annapurna, our expedition. And then I wrote another book called Breaking Trail, kind of my life story, how I got to Annapurna. And most of the chapters have an adventure like Denali or walking across the Himalayas or our endless winter. Anyway, different of my adventures I describe, but a lot of it is trying to figure out. I was raised by really conservative Orthodox Jewish grandparents on the south side of Chicago, where I wasn't allowed to go to the beach or ride horses because it was too dangerous. And so how did I get from the south side of Chicago not being allowed to even ride a horse, you know, to climbing these mountains? And so Breaking Trail took me like 20 years to write. It was like a big, almost personal therapy project, figuring out about my life. And the last sentence of Breaking Trail, when I finished the book, my daughter was just starting college and I'd been writing the book, doing leadership training for companies, but kind of being a mom, being at home. And I'm an extrovert. I thought, oh my goodness, my daughter's going to college. I want to go back to doing science, but I haven't done science. I quit doing science to walk across the Himalayas like in 1980. This was 2006. So for 26 years, I hadn't done science. You know, I'd been a mom, done adventure trips. I had an adventure travel business. And so I thought, how can I get back to science? And the last sort of sentence of Breaking Trail is, the future lies in front of me like an unbroken snow slope. I want to find a way to use my scientific training to break trail to a better world. And that all sounded very poetic and nice, but I was clueless about how I was going to do it and what was going to happen next. That's part two. And I have to tell you that since that day when I wrote that sentence and finished my book and started my new chapter, every day of my life has been like Annapurna, I swear. So exciting. I know, and my daughter says to me, Mom, every time I talk to you, either the best thing in the world has happened or the worst thing in the world. And so this all started because of the fact that that same Tris flame retardant that was we got out of kids' pajamas, I discovered was back in furniture. And I founded the Green Science Policy Institute. And what we do is we do really good scientific research. We write papers. Then we bring people together from government, business, academics, and the nonprofit world to find solutions to remove chemicals like Tris, to remove harmful chemicals from everyday products so we can all be healthier. And then we do a lot of communication. We do a lot of press and media work to get the word out. That's what we did with the kids' pajamas in the 70s. And that's what we've been doing ever since. And with all that, we are able to change government policy here in the US. We actually get bills passed in the Congress, and to work with big companies to change their purchasing so they're buying healthier products, with to work with manufacturers and retailers. So now I'm going to tell you my current Annapurna stories. And it's really similar because we're working with great teams of scientists from all over the world with a very focused goal, not the summit of Annapurna, but a healthier world for all of us, which I think is even more important. So here in the US, chemicals are not really regulated. There's one law that passed in 1976, and all the chemicals around at that point were grandfathered, you're fine. And that included like these Tris chemicals, something like asbestos, where 10,000 people a year die of asbestos disease in the United States, and our Environmental Protection Agency can't regulate asbestos. People don't use it because of lawsuits, but it's not regulated. New chemicals, no requirements for data. So it's a huge problem, this 80,000 untested chemicals. And the other problem is when a chemical is phased out, the replacement is really similar. So you remember the brominated Tris in kids' pajamas was replaced with the chlorinated Tris. Here we have a flame retardant. You just can see that looks, there's two rings with 10 bromines around it, decabromo, diphenyl ether. It's persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic. And it got phased out after years and years of research and advocacy. And the replacement is two rings, 10 bromines, decabromodiphenylethane, different bond, but same molecule, similar properties. So these are big problems, 80,000 chemicals. And when you have years of research and you phase one out, it's replaced with the chemical cousin. So we came up with the idea that there were actually, out of those 80,000 chemicals, six families or classes that contain most of the harmful chemicals in everyday products. And this is true in the US and Canada and also in the EU. So I'm not sure where I saw the lines, probably more with the EU, would that be right? But nonetheless, I think you would have the same problems. And so the six classes, and I'll talk more about them, are the PFAS, that's used to make like stain repellents and things waterproof. It's in ski waxes, antimicrobials, flame retardants, bisphenols and phthalates used as plasticizers, some solvents and certain metals. And I encourage you to go to our website, sixclasses.org, and you can watch a 4-minute video on each of these six classes and an introduction. So in half an hour at sixclasses.org, you can learn about where most of the really harmful chemicals are in everyday products that you use. And it talks about why they're harmful, what you can do to reduce your exposure. And we also put in a success story of reducing their use. So it isn't too depressing, because some of my friends would go, oh my gosh, I looked at that and it was so depressing to learn that there are these bad chemicals in everything around me. But it isn't in everything. And once you know what they are, you can actually take steps to make your home and your life healthier. And that also helps move the market away from harmful things towards healthier things. So I encourage everybody, I think I heard we're gonna have a lot of viewers. I hope there's a big spike in viewers of people who are watching, I mean, who go to sixclasses.org. So as I said, in less than half an hour. So now I'm gonna take, oh yeah, and if the chemicals in these classes, we don't necessarily say you could never use it because some of these chemicals are useful, but to say, is it necessary? So if you say to a mom, you can have a beautiful stain repellent carpet or couch, but the chemicals in the stain repellent are very harmful and they're going to be in your children when they crawl on the carpet for years and on the planet forever, she might not think it's necessary or worth it. But if she says, no, I really have to have a white shag carpet that I can drop Coca-Cola and ice cream on, then say, is there a safer alternative to this PFAS stain repellent? So I'm going to tell you a little bit more about some of these chemicals and then some success stories. We have been extraordinarily successful at effecting change, climbing our Annapurna with our team of scientists from all over the world and business people and government people and NGOs. So my favorite class, because it's the very worst, are the highly fluorinated stain repellent chemicals called PFAS. And the reason they're so bad is the bond between carbon and fluorine is the strongest bond in the periodic table. It doesn't break ever. So that makes these molecules really useful for stain and water repellency. As I said, they're in ski waxes, they're in Gore-Tex jackets, but they're forever chemicals. They last forever. And when they studied, most of them have turned out to be harmful. Other places, they're used on carpeting, carpet cleaning, food packaging, furniture, cosmetics, outdoor gear and clothing, sealants, coatings, nonstick cookware, Teflon is made with them, car seats, and firefighting foam is a huge problem. The foam used to put out aviation fires and then just dumped into the earth and water is PFAS. And that means around airports all over the world, there is contaminated drinking water, quite likely in Iceland. I don't know if you've looked yet, if you have problems with PFAS, but just about everywhere people look, they unfortunately find it. So PFAS exposure is a health concern. It's in almost everybody. And the exposure has been linked to cancer, high cholesterol, obesity, immune suppression, and a whole lot of other health problems. So there is a great film that came out recently called Dark Waters. I really recommend it. It's the story of an attorney with whom we work who fights the PFOA contamination, and he's played by Mark Ruffalo, who's a famous actor. I hadn't heard of him before, but maybe you have. And Anne Hathaway's his wife. And it's a really great film about these chemicals and how they're contaminating water in North Carolina and West Virginia. And so these chemicals are really problematic and really hard to clean up. And it's much better to try to prevent their use than to try to clean them up. In the US, tens of millions of people have contaminated drinking water, and the cost of providing just clean drinking water, filtering them out for a community can be $100 million a year, just huge amounts. And that is just doesn't help with the environment or wildlife. So you really want to only use these chemicals if they're really necessary. So one of the papers we did is we looked at fast food packaging paper and discovered that about 40%, you know, of wraps around hamburgers and tacos and things like that contain PFAS, and that they tended to be put in compost, and then the compost contained PFAS. And then if you grew plants, fruits and vegetables, and quote, organic compost made from these wrappers, then your fruits and vegetables would contain it. So after we learned this, we wrote a paper and brought it to the attention of the fast food industry. And a lot of things happened in the US, so it's going, being phased out, but Denmark is way ahead. And we actually have been working with the Danish Co-op, a big grocery store that banned PFAS in their packaging several years ago and was very activist getting the government on board. And now Denmark has been, the country has banned all PFAS in paper food packaging. Some states in the US have. So this, and it started with a scientific paper, and that's what we think is you write a scientific paper, you get the word out and things happen. Carpeting is another example. That's the largest source of exposure for children. And this is a paper just talking about a Canadian family with really high levels because of home carpet treatment. We started working with the carpet industry, educating them about the harm of the chemicals. They had originally done one of these regrettable substitutions where they went from one kind of PFAS that was banned to another kind that wasn't, but was equally bad. And working together, the carpet industry decided January 1st, 2020, they would take all PFAS out of all carpets from the major US carpet companies, and they have. So Home Depot and Lowe's, the place that sell a lot of carpets in the US, say they're not selling carpets with any PFAS anymore. So again, this is an example where the science was used to educate an industry and the industry changed. All these manufacturers have decided not to use any PFAS. We work with IKEA, and way back in 2014, they learned about the harm at one of our retreats. And by 2015, IKEA had removed all PFAS from their shower curtains. Molly wants to say hello. This is Molly. She says hello to all of you. So they had removed PFAS from their shower curtains, their umbrellas, all their products. And then Crate and Barrel heard about it and they did the same, and some American companies did. Most of these companies decided not to use any PFAS because Greenpeace in Germany, wanting to protect water in China, because manufacturing with PFAS really contaminates water, they signed agreements with Greenpeace. But in any case, all these brands do not use any PFAS, which is really a good thing. And in Europe, things are really moving forward. Germany and the Nordic companies have proposed to phase out all PFAS that are unessential at the latest by 2025. So this is a big success story. And I think Iceland goes with the EU. Is that right, Villa?
Yeah, in many aspects, yes. You're not part of it, but yes.
Yeah, so hopefully you'll be following on this. So now it's kind of good news. Carpeting doesn't have it. It's out of the way in food packaging and furniture. The outdoor industry is moving slowly. If you look, you can find jackets without Gore-Tex. Many of the companies, I have a nice Royal Robbins coat that says PFAS free. That's why I bought it. And I think actually North Face sent me a PFAS free jacket I'm looking forward to using, and some of the other brands. Sierra Designs has one, but it's not everything. They have like one or two and they tend to be more costly, but we're hopeful. And firefighting foam, that was one of, if I have a slide, but one of our biggest victories is we've been educating people in the House and the Senate in the US to move away from firefighting foam. The Scandinavian countries and Australia all used firefighting foam with no PFAS. In America, it's said that the American military had to use PFAS. And I said, even, you know, I go around saying if there were foam that was 10 times as good and cost a tenth as much, we couldn't use it in America because we're required to use the PFAS foam. And so really great news in the defense budget for 2020, it forbids the military from using any PFAS in their firefighting foam, the US military. And that will be followed by Canada. And a number of EU countries are already on that path. Again, I'm not sure where Iceland is, but maybe somebody listening wants to look into that and point out what's happening in Scandinavia and in the US. And maybe Iceland wants to move away from firefighting foam with PFAS. Just a thought. So we're very happy that these, you know, things have happened. And again, it's been scientific work that we and our colleagues have done that we've used to educate decision makers in government, in the outdoor industry, in the carpet industry, in the food packaging industry. So taking the science can really change things. Now, if you get as interested in PFAS as I am, we sort of joke, a bunch of us, that we're like the PFAS obsessed. We have a website called PFAS Central, where you can read the latest news on PFAS, the latest science, policy, there's events, jobs, and there's a page called PFAS Free that lists products that do not contain any PFAS. And we made the page because these communities that have been drinking PFAS contaminated water for decades, where people have the health problems associated with PFAS, they said, please tell us which products don't contain PFAS so we can buy those. So if you're concerned, and I think we probably have fairly similar products as in the US. It's a US EU list, but I suspect your products are similar. So I'm going to tell you about my other famous favorite class that you heard already a bit about, which is flame retardants. And back in the 70s, people thought flame retardants were a good thing, and they put them in kids' pajamas and furniture and baby product foam and building insulation. And they never asked, do they provide a fire safety benefit and are they harmful? And the answer is they don't really provide a fire safety benefit, and a significant one, and they're extremely harmful. So they're used in TV cases, building insulation, textiles, car seats, infant mattresses, carpet padding, blinds, paints and coatings, wire and cable, transportation, gym foam blocks, furniture foam. And the problem is they're what's called semi-volatile. They come out of products. So if you have a couch that has flame retardant foam, 5% of the weight of the foam is a flame retardant chemical, and it's coming out and dropping into dust. You get a little dust on your hand and you eat a sandwich, you're eating flame retardants. Cats have up to 100 times higher levels than humans, and that's because they lick themselves and they eat the flame retardants. And then really sadly, young children who crawl in the dust and put their hands in their mouths, their levels of flame retardants will be 3 to 10 times as high as their parents, and sometimes 100 times higher. And that's at times when their brains are developing, and the last thing you need are flame retardants, which are neurotoxic. There have been so many studies of a flame retardant that was used in all furniture foam pretty much in the US from the 70s to when it was phased out in about 2005. And because our whole population was exposed, they learned that women with higher levels took longer to get pregnant, and that thyroid hormones during pregnancy were changed so that their children had various neurological and reproductive problems. There was a calculation, the average American and Canadian child lost 4 or 5 IQ points because of flame retardants. And they're cancer causing. And so, you know, I guess too many of my friends have gotten cancer in the last years. And you can't say the flame retardants are the reason, but they're in all of us. And we know that they're not helping their health. There is no fire safety benefit from the flame retardants. I won't explain why now, but if you go to our website or watch the flame retardant 4-minute video, you'll learn why. And so there's no benefit except to the bottom line of the chemical producers, who are the strong advocates for these flame retardants. So we discovered all that. We tried to have legislation, and then we met the Chicago Tribune, some Pulitzer Prize winning reporters, and they wrote an amazing series called Playing with Fire. And the subtitle says it all: a deceptive campaign by industry brought toxic flame retardants into our homes and into our bodies, and the chemicals don't even work as promised. And this series won all kinds of awards, and it gave, at the same time, I had been working with legislation, trying to change things because we could actually have things that were more fire safe without flame retardants by just stopping the fire in the fabric. Foam is flammable. You don't want the fire to reach the foam. Once it reaches the foam, the fire retardants don't do any good. And so I started hiking with our governor, Jerry Brown's senior advisor. And he happened to live near me and have a dog, so we'd go hiking. And anybody who went hiking with me in those days got a big earful about flame retardants. My friends would sort of say, we'll go hiking with you, but you have to promise you'll only talk about flame retardants half the time. I was a little bit obsessed with flame retardants. And so the governor's senior advisor learned about the harm of the flame retardants and lack of benefit. And he told the governor, and this Chicago Tribune story gave him authority to do something. And the law was changed. So if you buy a couch now in North America, there'll be a label on it saying whether or not it contains flame retardants. And it will probably be checked that it contains no added flame retardants. So this is a big deal. All the furniture now in North America doesn't contain flame retardants. So everybody's home is healthier, and we've actually increased fire safety. So I will put in my glamour slide. Because I had done this, I got a lot of recognition from the governor, and I got awarded a gold medal for the California Hall of Fame, along with two of my heroes. On the far left, that's Robert Redford, and on the far right, that's Joan Baez, and I'm sitting there next to the governor. So that was like the most glamorous night ever, and it was for getting the toxic flame retardants out of our furniture, which it was a California law. So I'm going to end again, reminding you, please take half an hour, watch the videos, and learn how to reduce your own exposure and maybe help move the market away from these products with these six classes of harmful chemicals. So I just want to say, if any of you want to stay in touch with me, I put out a quarterly personal newsletter, and could you put that in the chat, the message that I, do you have that, Villa?
Yeah, it's already in the chat.
Oh, good, thank you. Thank you. So in the chat, I hope you can see, it says, if you want to hear from me four times a year, my personal newsletter, if you go to arlenebloom.com contact, or just arlenebloom.com, I think when you get there, the opening screen says sign up. Or if you really get interested in these harmful chemicals like we are, we do a once a month newsletter with kind of the latest and greatest news about the chemicals and how to reduce exposure and cool little videos and things. So I hope some of you will want to stay in touch, and please, you know, sign up for the quarterly personal newsletter or the monthly newsletter. And you can just send me questions if you have them at Arlene or at arlenebloom.com or through any of these websites. So I'll just end by saying, by limiting the use of these six classes, I think we can have a healthier world. And for me, as I said, this was just like climbing Annapurna, because my knees aren't so good now. Going up and down all those hills across the Himalayas was not great for my knees after all these years. I can only hike 2 or 3 hours a day, so I can't really go trekking in Nepal anymore. I can ski all day, which is very fortunate. I hope I can come hiking with some of you in Iceland another summer. But the feeling I had on Annapurna of having great people all together, a big team. Our team wasn't just the climber, it was all the people selling t-shirts and supporting us, having like a big international team at that point focused on giving women the opportunity to climb one of the world's highest and most dangerous mountains. Now I have that same feeling on bringing people together from all over the world. We work with international scientists who study PFAS and flame retardants. And now our expedition is really a healthier world for everyone. So I feel really lucky to have found something that feels like a high altitude expedition, but for someone of my age is more appropriate. So anyway, I'd be happy if anyone has any questions, either from the chat, which maybe shall I stop the share? I'll stop the share and then I can see the chat.
Thank you, Arlene. Wow. Thank you for sharing your story. I'm blown away. I'm just speechless. I just wanted to ask you, because you have a very long experience with leadership and in both fields, both with your science work and working with people for different industries or corporation and science and so on, and also in the mountains and the hard environment. Can you give us a little bit of insight of how you form teams and what examples a good team and a good leader?
Well, I actually taught leadership from when I got back from walking across the Himalayas. I had an adventure travel business. And then when my daughter was born, I couldn't do adventure travel. And I actually did leadership training in Silicon Valley for about a decade. And so I think the most important thing is finding a team of people who share a common vision. You know, is it the summit of Annapurna? Is it a healthier world without reduced toxics? And then for Annapurna, to pick our team, women who were interested, we went climbing with them. We had a little expedition in the snow and we figured out who got along well. Because I think people who can work well together as a team, you find out through trying. And so finding a team with a shared vision and then, you know, making a plan of step by step in climbing mountains and in what I do, it's overcoming endless obstacles, you know, just plodding up the mountain. There's an avalanche, a snowstorm, a Yeti, whatever. You know, you just kind of have to keep focusing on your goal and keep moving slowly and steadily, but taking time to stop and celebrate and have a party. You know, you can't keep plodding up the mountain always. And I have always found that if this vision is something that reflects your values, it's really important to you, that you're passionate about. So for me, I was passionate about giving women an opportunity to climb high mountains because back in the 70s, there was this belief that they couldn't. And I thought women should be able to do whatever they want, whether it's climbing high mountains or being scientists. So my passion then was really about opportunities for women. And now my passion is, it is so sad that, you know, like as I said, several of my friends have died of cancer in the last, you know, year. And I know that these chemicals are cancer causing and are contributing. And the only reason they're around is to make a profit for the chemical industry. It's really sad and who promote them. So my passion is trying to move away from harmful chemicals to safer ones and figuring out what to do about the chemical industry it's kind of the petrochemical industry. Actually, climate change, plastic pollution, and chemical pollution are all related and they're all part of the petrochemical industry. And I frankly don't know the answer, but when you realize they're all related, you realize that the petrochemical industry needs a new business model for climate change, for plastic pollution, and for toxics, and they're all really important. So if anybody has any ideas, please share them with us.
We have a question from Osk. She's asking, how can we be more environmentally friendly decision, make more environmentally friendly decisions when choosing our outer gear and clothing?
So that's a problem, because I know I was talking to the head of sustainability for one of the largest outdoor companies. I won't say the company because he'd probably rather be quoted. And he said, you know, our customers would not be happy to learn that most of what we're selling them is petrochemicals plus your six classes. So sadly enough, outdoor clothing has a lot of these bad chemicals, particularly the PFAS. And I think people have to start being aware of it and saying, you know, writing the companies, we don't want this. It's for ski wax because ski wax contains PFAS and that makes it the fastest, but then it's all over the countryside. And there's been studies that people who do ski waxing get high levels in their bodies. And so the Olympics committee has said no PFAS at the next Olympics, which is fantastic. They still sell ski waxes with PFAS. So I think it's important to ask for not, you can buy them with or without. And if you're aware of it, you can choose to buy without. For outer gear, it is hard, you know, you have to consciously make an effort. Actually, go to our website, go to PFAS Central or I think there's a banner saying where the PFAS free page is, or just Google PFAS free. And we list a number of outdoor manufacturers. Most of them are European, but some US, but I think you probably get your gear from, again, European and US manufacturers. So that the PFAS free page will give you choices of where to get gear that is PFAS free. And that is one of the biggest problems. So thank you for asking. Good question.
Thank you. We also have a question from Marianne. She's asking, what would you advise to a woman that has passion to make a difference in this world? But her own fear, lack of confidence, fear of being different, fear of not succeeding is getting in the way. What advice would you give to a woman searching how she can be an influencer?
Well, that's another great question. And, you know, it's really hard because I have been so fortunate to have so many of the things I dreamed of become reality. And I still don't have as much confidence sometimes. So I try to think back on my successes. Like Denali was very transformational for me because that turned out to be a really hard thing. And in fact, I didn't know that. But I met the head guide on Denali, who is a remarkable person because he did the first solo winter ascent of Denali. And if you think about a solo winter ascent of Denali, it's pitch black. There are huge crevasses. You climb this mountain carrying huge ladders on either side. So if you fall in a crevasse, so it's crazy, you know, climbing in the dark and it's 40 below zero. So doesn't that sound insane?
Anyway. It's quite amazing.
So he was the first person to do a solo winter ascent. And he said, he happened to be at a meeting where I told the story of rescuing Grace. And he said he couldn't believe it. He'd never heard of anyone else who'd gotten someone down alive from the summit. He said the worst thing that ever happened in his life as a guide is he had a unconscious person on the summit and with a group of clients who were all getting cold and could not, had to leave her there. And so I realized we did something incredibly hard. We didn't know it, how hard it was when we did it. You know, we did what we had to, but it gave me a lot of confidence. And so I have to say that I try to think back to my successes and encourage myself. And you might like my book, Breaking Trail, because it kind of describes my life and how I started out very unconfident. I was given very bad messages as a child that my parents were divorced when I was really young and people weren't divorced in those days and it was considered just scandalous. And I really had bad messages and had no confidence. And Denali kind of changed that. And then each time I've been successful, and now by the time I got that gold medal with Robert Redford and Joan Baez, I was like, wow, but I still don't always have confidence. You know, I think it's human and particularly women, I think we're brought up that way. So I would, in your life, try to remember times that you've done things that were really good and important. And you might like Breaking Trail, which you can get from Amazon or unfortunately, it's less expensive on Amazon and they do have it on Kindles, or you can buy it from our website where I sign it. So it'll give you examples.
Yeah, it's a really, really good book. I also want to maybe follow up on that a little bit, because when you were starting in your early years of mountaineering, you faced a lot of challenges regarding sexism in the mountaineering. There were people who were trying to prevent women go into mountaineering. What was the biggest challenge you got and or hardest part of it, and how did you deal with it?
Well, it was really upsetting, I have to say. And I'll tell a couple quick stories. One was when I was in graduate school, all my friends were going on this expedition to Afghanistan. And I'd hardly ever traveled, and it was just like a dream to go. And I applied, and then the leader wrote me and he said, well, and I actually, of my friends, I had climbed high in Peru in the Andes. So I'd climbed much higher than any of my friends, my climbing partners, but they were all guys. And they all got invited and I didn't, even though I'd climbed higher and been on expeditions. And the leader wrote me and he said, well, it's really hard because you have had a lot of experience, but we think having one woman and 10 men would provide excretory problems on the open ice. Oh my goodness. And, you know, I was devastated. But when I wrote my book, Annapurna, I began with that quote. You know, I turned it around. But when we were going to Annapurna, it was funny. My boyfriend then, a guy named Richard Isherwood, who's a very strong climber, decided he'd go to Annapurna 2 while I was going to Annapurna 1. And it was just two of them. They wrote the British Mountaineering, whatever. They got their approval and their permission. We were 10 women. We'd all had a lot of high altitude experience, and the American Alpine Club would not approve us because it was too dangerous. And that was, again, really upsetting. You know, here he was, just two guys, no problem, 10 women, no permission, because what if a woman died? It would be bad publicity. Anyway, they finally did approve us and we did get our permit. But, you know, it was upsetting. And I think it's not like that so much anymore, but it can be subtler. You know, it still is harder when you look at leadership positions for women. And then, of course, for minorities. You've all heard about Black Lives Matter, the deep, deep racism in our society. And I have to say that I've always considered myself totally non-racist. Like, I've lived in, you know, Nepal, I've lived around the world, but I hadn't really gotten the depth of the racism in America until Black Lives Matter, you know, just the extent of it. And it's good to understand it. So I think all these things slowly get better and there are setbacks. Our current government in the US is a bit of a setback, but we're all very anxious about what's going to happen next week.
So. We are. But thank you for breaking the trail for the rest of us, because I'm pretty sure that this was quite hard in times. We have a question from Sigga Ragna. She is actually one of the expedition girls in Iceland. She has done some quite amazing sailing expeditions. She's asking about leadership, both to Arlene and Villa. What are your views of all-woman teams, mixed expedition teams?
Maybe you Sorry, I didn't quite. Could you repeat the question? I'm looking in the...
What are your views on all-women teams versus mixed expedition teams?
Well, I've certainly done both. When we had our first, like Denali, it was like a big adventure because everybody said women couldn't climb Denali, and we sort of felt like the grown-ups weren't there. You know, here we were, we all landed on the Denali Glacier, all women, and it really seemed amazing just to figure out what we could do. By now, I think it's not that extraordinary, you know, but I guess you've done all women hikes. There's somewhat different energy. So I like them both. But what about you?
Well, I have to agree. I like them both. And I've done both mixed. I've done solo. I've done all women. And all of them are great. And all of them can deliver some special things, because everyone has strength and weaknesses, and we can all help each other in one way or another. So I think it's just depend on the project and the people who want to go on the project. What's the best mixture? And I've done some wonderful expeditions with both. Sirisi actually was she was in an all-women expedition across Vatnajökull earlier this year. She says, thank you for the lecture, amazing life. Do you think there's still a lot of sexism today in women's hiking?
I don't know about hiking. You know, it seems like It's okay. I mean, I have to say, I started running in the 60s. And for about the first 3 years, I never saw another woman running. And when I did, we stopped and exchanged phone numbers because we thought it'd be fun to run with a woman. And it's hard to believe because now it seems like 2/3 of the people I see running are women, and there have been women. I actually ran in the first all women's marathon, which was in the 70s, which wow. again was like, oh my goodness, because you know, in the beginning, you know that in the beginning women weren't allowed to run marathons. And the first woman who did was like chased, they tried to get her out of the marathon. So I think things like running, there's not prejudice about women. And I don't think in hiking, possibly in, you know, very high level elite expeditions, but there's often women now in expeditions. So I should ask you, I'm not as current. It seems pretty fair these days. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it has changed a lot just since I started. I started my mountaineering almost 20 years ago, and I was quite young at the time. And then girls were a minority, but they are not anymore. And in our groups that we run through both our company and in another associations and with companies in Iceland, we see that women are quite often now the majority of the groups. And it has been quite amazing to see the shift. And I sometimes explain to people when I guided my first trip to Hvannadalshnjúkur, it was 2005, that's the highest mountain in Iceland. It was a group of 100 people, so it was quite a big group. There were 7 girls or ladies with me and 93 guys. Today, I mean, I would say it would be maybe 60%, 60-70% women and 30% men in those trips, at least for our company. Wow, this has been amazing, Nidaline. Just maybe one final question. What advice can you give us now when we are going through this pandemic, this challenging times? Some of us are getting sick, family members or someone around us, someone we love. And maybe there's a little bit of a fear out there. What advice can you give us to stick through that challenge?
Well, I'm always an optimist. Yes. It's actually interesting. Here in Berkeley, we've been told that there's supposed to be 70 mile an hour winds and dry conditions and maybe fires, and that we should evacuate tonight.
Okay.
But I actually don't think so. But I brought in my cat carriers, and I'm prepared if it happens, but I'm not worried. So I guess I am an optimist, and I try not to worry too much about things, but to take precautions. So maybe that's an example, you know. So I think it's important to prepare as best you can, but then if possible, not to worry. And I do think for everything that it's so good to have a picture in your mind of what you want and to really focus on what it is that you want and to believe in yourself. And I guess I've learned that through my life and adventures, and it's hard. It doesn't come naturally always, but that would be my advice.
Thank you.
So I hope I can come to Iceland another time. I said I was hoping to come this summer, and Iceland didn't want Americans with reason. But anyway, yes. When the time is right, I would love to come to Iceland and meet some of you and go walking slowly. I'm not such a fast walker, but I love to be in the mountains. Any mountains, it's fantastic. So I look forward to seeing the mountains of Iceland.
So you will be very welcome. Then we will all assist you to make your experience very joyful.
Well, everybody who comes to Iceland comes back very enthusiastic.
And now you have a lot of new friends in Iceland.
Thank you for arranging this and inviting me. It's really been a pleasure.
Darlene, I thank you so much for being with us tonight. We really appreciate it that you took your time to do so. And especially now if you're having the situation of fires coming in. And I also wanted to remind the people who are listening to sign up for Arlene's post list, and also maybe recommend the t-shirt. A lot of us have the t-shirt, we love the t-shirt, and sometimes we really put on the t-shirts and read the book.
I'll recommend the book.
They are very good.
I have a very small t-shirt business. Not for profit, but anyway, if people want the t-shirt. But yeah, I think Annapurna and Breaking Trail are both fairly inspirational. So I encourage, I think they provide some inspiration, and we can all use some inspiration right now.
I think we can.
A bit of a tough time. And I do hope some of you will sign up to hear from me 4 times a year, or even monthly, if you get interested in toxic chemicals, because I love sharing information and staying in touch with people, so we can stay in touch that way.
So yes, we will post it also on Facebook and to our social media.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. But thank you, Arlene, and thank you to all of you that joined us tonight, and we look forward to see you again. Namaste.
Namaste.